Greetings and salutations, and welcome to Colin's Last Stand, the independent, fan-supported show dedicated to our shared love of politics, history, knowledge, and free thought. Thank you for being here with me today. I hope you're doing well. Today, I want to focus on the single most bizarre component of the Bill of Rights to the American Constitution, the Third Amendment. We hear a great deal about the freedoms assured to us elsewhere in the Constitution's first 10 amendments, but we rarely, if ever, hear about the Third Amendment. In fact, I'd venture a guess that if you stop some people on the street in any town USA,
what is this?
Any town USA.
You'd find that most of them don't know a thing about it, even though they could likely tell you something about the First, Second, Fourth, and Fifth Amendments as an example. This is totally understandable, by the way. By 21st century standards, the Third Amendment is strange and quaint, while the content and context of the First Amendment is absolutely timeless. But to the founding generation, the Third Amendment was essential, a reflection on their shared experiences with the British Empire, and an acknowledgement that if they weren't careful, the past could easily repeat itself. Here's what the Third Amendment says verbatim, quote, "No soldier shall in time of peace be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, nor in time of war, but in a manner to be prescribed by law," end quote. What the amendment basically says is the government cannot compel you to house and take care of soldiers on your property, especially against your will, unless Congress for some reason decided otherwise during a time of war. I've always been fascinated by the Third Amendment. I know it's a reflection of American colonial experience during and after the French and Indian War, and into the turbulent decade of the 1770s. And I know that there was a conflict around the time of the Constitutional Convention following the war, separating those who felt like rights were innate and didn't need to be individually named, from those who felt like spelling out what one's rights were would guarantee their protection. But part of the fun of Colin's Last Stand is me going into a subject without many answers, lacking all the information I need. In other words, I get to learn too. And I learned a ton writing and researching this episode. So let's jump in. I started by reading what Gordon Wood had to say about the Third Amendment. Gordon Wood is one of the most famous and prestigious American historians to ever walk the earth. Educated at Harvard, Wood is a Pulitzer Prize and Bancroft Prize winning historian that has taught not only at his alma mater, but at other prestigious institutions as well, including Cambridge and Brown. His seminal book, The Creation of the American Republic, is an absolute must-read for anyone serious about learning about the origins of the United States. In short, Gordon Wood is an absolute G. He's a personal favorite of mine. Hell, Matt Damon even mentions him in Good Will Hunting.
That's gonna last until next year. You're gonna be in here regurgitating Gordon Wood.
Wood wrote a fascinating synopsis of the Third Amendment's origins and implications over at the National Constitution Center's website, and his knowledge shed a ton of light onto the subject for me. There he says in part, quote, "When the amendment was written in the 18th century, Americans and Englishmen in general believed that the issue of quartering troops in private homes was of great and palpable significance. During the course of their history, the English had developed a deep dislike of standing armies. They especially objected to the government's compelling them to quarter soldiers in their homes," end quote. It's that inherent dislike of standing armies that intrigued me most. The reality, according to Wood, is that the hostile English and later American stance on quartering soldiers actually stands in stark juxtaposition to their feelings on standing armies, which they also distrusted. Wood makes the compelling case that quartering soldiers among the citizenry was a way to disperse and lessen their collective power, or as Wood puts it, quote, "that concentrations of soldiers in barracks might pose military threats to the people's liberties," end quote. Even then, the people were wary of concentrated, lawless, and intimidating power for power's sake. But the English couldn't have it both ways. Towards the end of the 17th century, the Glorious Revolution gripped the British Empire, causing a tumultuous series of events that resulted in, among other things, the 1689 Bill of Rights. And in there was, you guessed it, provisions on standing armies in peacetime and the quartering of soldiers therein, to the effect of you can't have a standing army without Parliament's permission, and soldiers can't be lawlessly quartered among the population. If that sounds familiar, well, it should. The 1689 Bill of Rights was an important cornerstone in the creation of the American Bill of Rights a full century later. This gives us some historical context for the Third Amendment, but it doesn't give us the full philosophical picture. Help there comes by way of Villanova political science professor Colleen Sheehan, who, on the Foundation for Economic Education's website, points to the idea of a man's home as his castle, as coined by Sir Edward Coke. In the mid-17th century, Coke spoke out about states of martial law and the so-called billeting of soldiers on private property. Quote, "the house of an Englishman is to him as his castle," end quote. Professor Sheehan also found an interesting William Pitt quote that brings the point home even more, and shows just to what lengths an Enlightenment-era Englishman was willing to go to make the case for sanctity of a person's private residence. Pitt is a famous British head of state who made a name for himself during the French and Indian War, from whence American colonial complaints of quartering and billeting hail from. The quote Sheehan dug up from him on this point is fascinating, for here's what he said so forcefully. Quote, The poorest man may in his cottage bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England cannot enter," end quote. That's powerful stuff coming from a man like him, and is yet another foundational element of what would become the Third Amendment. Jumping ahead to the French and Indian War, known as the Seven Years' War outside of the colonies, the exact situation the founding generation would find themselves in becomes crisper. And it's those philosophical and political foundations, the 1689 Bill of Rights, the general distrust of standing armies and their disproportionate power, a resistance to quartering, and the negative martial law-driven effects all of that can have on a population that drove the issue forward. The French and Indian War raged from 1754 to 1763, and was one component of a far larger conflict. The name is confusing to some people, as it seems to indicate that the French and Indians were fighting each other, but it's actually the opposite. The British Empire was waging war on the French and their numerous Indian allies in North America. French and British relations at the time were in a perpetual state of flux, and the two empires constantly found themselves at odds. We won't get into the French and Indian War here today, but needless to say, the war was fought over precious colonial real estate in the New World, a somewhat inevitable set of circumstances that would arise whenever multiple, eager governments found themselves keen on expanding their land, resource holdings, and global influence. Nonetheless, the French and Indian War started the clock on conflict between the British Empire and the colonial population. The British won the conflict, leaving the French bruised and embarrassed, but it came at a high cost. The British ran up huge debt during the war, something that directly leads to the American Revolution just over a decade later. But the British also felt the need to keep tons of troops in the colonies, ostensibly to protect their new land holdings. As Gordon Wood points out, this conflicted with the feeling of self-reliance the colonial population felt so deeply, and it also economically infringed on a group of people who couldn't afford the inconvenience. Here's what he had to say on the matter. Quote, "Americans preferred to rely for their protection on local militia, not professional soldiers. Although the peace treaty of 1763 ended the war and ousted France from the North American continent, the British government believed it still needed tens of thousands of soldiers in America in order to police the newly acquired territories," end quote. This led, Wood explains, to the Quartering Act of 1765. Quote, "The colonists were to provide barracks for the soldiers, and if they were not available, the troops were to be billeted in inns, stables, and alehouses. If these were insufficient, the governors and councils of the provinces were authorized to use uninhabited houses, barns, and other buildings to lodge the soldiers. The colonists were required to furnish provisions and necessaries for the troops, including firewood, bedding, and beer," end quote. For the sake of fairness, there's one important thing to note here. Quartering in this case is more about an infringement on hotel-like properties that expect the coming and going of travelers, as well as structures otherwise unused. According to the National Constitution Center's Third Amendment Myths write-up, quote, "The British military rarely took over private homes when it sought shelter during its occupation of the Americas," end quote. In other words, this was an infringement on people's economic rights, since provisional accommodations were to be made, in addition to the sanctity of controlling what's going on their property. An important distinction, though not one of relevance to the people who were paying the bills, losing rooms for rent, and sheltering hated enemy soldiers in, say, barns where their horses should be eating and resting. Towards the end of the 1760s, things were starting to get heated in the American colonies, especially up north. The massive British debt incurred from the French and Indian War started to strangle the empire, and Parliament felt that the colonies needed to pay back some of the debt, as well as contribute to the colonies' continued protection. For the colonists, this was a complicated issue. While the British did fight to protect the colonies in the French and Indian War, there were obviously deeply selfish and yet completely understandable reasons why they did. Like any state-owned colony, the British New World colonies were rife with important economic activities that benefited the home country. Territorial expansion was simply a means to an end. Plus, the colonies just became another front in the centuries-long British versus French fiasco. To many colonists, all this smacked of absolute bullshit, and they began to more actively resist. Fast forward a few years, and the British Empire had finally had enough, specifically with the colony known as Massachusetts, which had long been ground zero for revolutionary and even separatist zeal. The Boston Massacre occurred in 1770, and the Boston Tea Party in late 1773. As a result of that latter act of defiance in particular, in addition to years of building tension, the Coercive Acts, known in the American colonies as the Intolerable Acts, were passed in 1774. There were multiple components to the Coercive Acts, but the one component important to this video was the reassertion of 1765's Quartering Act. At this point, the powder keg was about to blow, and it did just 1 year later, outside of Boston. The American Revolution began in 1775, and it effectively ended at Yorktown, Virginia in 1781. As it was fought pretty much entirely on American soil, it goes without saying that British soldiers were all over the place, in and among colonial populations. Tens upon tens of thousands of British soldiers fought in the War of Independence. while American Census Bureau research conducted after the fact estimated that there were around 2.5 million colonists during the Revolution. The way these numbers jive with each other isn't inconsequential. Americans rubbed shoulders with redcoats for decades following the French and Indian Wars' conclusion, something that became even more pronounced when, during the Revolution, the British occupied Boston, New York City, and Philadelphia, the colony's three most populated cities. There would naturally be a ton of resentment brewing in this regard, no matter how the conflict itself turned out. Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence bore this out even more, and definitively proves that billeting enemy soldiers had long been on the minds of the American revolutionaries and those they represented. Jefferson, with help from John Adams, Benjamin Franklin, Robert Livingston, and Roger Sherman, crafted an eloquent piece of writing that struck at the heart of King George III and British Parliament, and made them and their fellow patriots some of the most wanted men in the entire world, who would, as Franklin so brilliantly put it, hang together or hang separately for the road they were embarking on. Much of the Declaration of Independence is a long laundry list of grievances the colonists had against the British Empire, directed at King George III himself. Within there is, you guessed it again, something about quartering soldiers. Quote, "He has kept among us, in times of peace, standing armies without the consent of our legislatures. He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to civil power. He has combined with others to subject us to jurisdiction foreign to our Constitution and unacknowledged by our laws, giving his assent to their acts of pretended legislation, for quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, for protecting them, by a mock trial, from punishment for any murders which they should commit on inhabitants of these states," end quote. So backtracking all the way to 1689's Bill of Rights over in Britain, and how Englishmen felt even then about standing armies and billeting soldiers, through to the colonial experience in the French and Indian War, and the continued occupation of their land after the war ended, with quartering still necessary, reinforced in 1765 and again in 1774, and then spelled out in black and white in the most famous document written in American history after a prolonged armed conflict? I think now we can see exactly how the Third Amendment came to be, even if we simply cannot relate to it today. Following the war and following the drafting of our original Constitution, the Articles of Confederation, the founders got together to ratify the US Constitution that we still live under today. That process ultimately also included the Bill of Rights, a James Madison penned addition to the James Madison penned Constitution. As Slate's Brian Palmer points out, the Bill of Rights amendments aren't even remotely in order. Indeed, the First Amendment as we know it was originally going to be the Third Amendment, except neither of the first two amendments voted on were ratified by Congress. So the Third Amendment and its voicing of concern over quartering and billeting troops sits where it is more than a matter of happenstance than anything else. And so that brings us to today, where the Third Amendment is, well, puzzling to say the very least, though hopefully a little less so than it was before you started watching this video. What's fascinating about the Third Amendment today isn't only its antiquated nature, but how little it's invoked in court at any level. That's how ridiculously obscure it is. Still, we shouldn't take it for granted. It serves a unique purpose, and some of our contemporaries even try to make legal hay by suing over it. Cornell Law School's annotated constitution notes that while the Supreme Court has never explicated the Third Amendment, which basically means that they've never delved into what it really means and implies, the law school's stance is it's, quote, obviously one guarantee of the preference for the civilian over the military, end quote. Our old friend Gordon Wood agrees, for he thinks, quote, "It suggests the individual's right of domestic privacy, that people are protected from governmental intrusion into their homes, and it is the only part of the Constitution that deals directly with the relationship between the rights of individuals and the military in both peace and war, rights that emphasize the importance of civilian control over the armed forces," end quote. In other words, there's power buried in the Third Amendment, something the aforementioned Professor Colleen Sheehan agrees with. She writes, quote, "To understand the Third Amendment to the Constitution, we should do well to appreciate its basis in not only English law, but in Lockean natural rights, and thus see the connection it has to both the Fifth and Ninth Amendments, which are also rooted in the natural rights of the individual," end quote. In case you're curious, the Fifth Amendment is chock full of stuff, protecting you from being held without trial and from being tried twice for the same crime, as an example. While the Ninth Amendment wisely points out that any rights not outlined in the Constitution or Bill of Rights doesn't mean those rights don't exist. James Madison was no fool. Meanwhile, the Rutherford Institution doubles down on these notions. Quote, "The Third Amendment reinforces the principle that civilian elected officials are superior to the military by prohibiting the military from entering any citizen's home without the consent of the owner," end quote. This is especially important stuff, because a foundation of the American Republic isn't only its separation of powers, but also its separation of military power from the power of duly elected officials, subjugating one under the other. In its own way, the Third Amendment eloquently makes that clear. Do people bring up the Third Amendment today? Sure they do. The 1982 Second Circuit case Engblom v. Carey revolves around the Third Amendment, specifically in regard to New York State employed correctional officers who were on strike and were kicked out of their housing to let National Guard troops live there instead. 1965's Griswold v. Connecticut, which revolved around the ban of contraceptives, invoked the very spirit of the Third Amendment and its contribution to a general feeling of individual freedom and a right to privacy. There's even a super interesting case during World War II, as outlined by Tom W. Bell, of American soldiers in Alaska's Aleutian Islands quartering themselves in the private homes of the natives there. The Third Amendment may not have the flash of the First Amendment, the endless debate of the Second, or the constant pointing to of the Tenth, but it's still relevant in contemporary times in its own way. The most recent case surrounding the Third Amendment is Mitchell versus the City of Henderson from 2015, in which a man's home was used by police officers to spy on his neighbors against his will. The Washington Post points out that the police were there for 9 hours. Website The Vola Conspiracy points out that it's the timing obstacle, as well as the nature of what a soldier is versus a cop, that stops these cases in their tracks. Either way, the case was thrown out. Still, it's at least an attempt to use the Third Amendment and get it in some much-needed action. So, there you have it, my little story about the Third Amendment. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, you'll find a bibliography in the video's description, as well as a reading list of some other stuff you may want to check out concerning the Third Amendment. Until we meet again for another episode of Colin's Last Stand, please keep the feedback coming, be good to each other in the comments, and above all else, keep on learning.